You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. 100 years ago this week, the 19th Amendment was ratified, extending the right to vote to some, but not all, women in America. To discuss how women voters have shaped our democracy, I spoke to Francine Farber, board member and past president of the League of Women Voters of Fresno, Amanda Renteria, CEO of Code for America, and former national political director of Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign, Ivy Cargyle, assistant professor of political science at CSU Bakersfield, and Desi Woods Jones, state president of Black Women Organized for Political Action. Francine, what are some of the things that many people don't know about the 19th Amendment and what it took to get it passed?
Well, even though this is the 100th anniversary, the fight for women's rights started a long time before that. Actually, it was about 72 years before that, in 1848. And just to get the feeling of how long ago that was, James Polk was the president of the United States. James Polk, when women started to fight for the right to vote by having a big conference, the first women's conference at Seneca Falls in New York, at which they developed the Declaration of Sentiments, the main part of which was the right to vote. But guess what? Even though there were many women there, and it was led by Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and it was supported by Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist, the vote failed. And nevertheless, as we say now, nevertheless, they persisted. And over many, many years, of course, by 1920, women got the right to vote. Although many individual states gave women the right to vote before that, including California in 1911. And there are lots of stories about that, but I don't want to take up all the time. So let's give other women on the panel a chance to talk, too.
Well, then let's do just that. Amanda, what is the significance of this 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment to you?
You know, it's what you realize when you hear 100 years is, you know, what it actually takes to get to a moment like the Democratic National Committee selection of a VP candidate who is a woman of color, or how long it takes and how hard it is to have a female presidential candidate on a major party's ticket. And you understand, for me, I got a firsthand view of that working for Secretary Clinton, but it does make me think about all those names and people who actually paved that way, that their stories don't quite get told, or we don't know about them, but you do see the labors of the work now. You do see a lot of younger women sort of think this is just the way it is. But over the course of history, it is people trying and kind of falling up short and then doing it again until finally you're there. And so when I think of 100 years, I think two things. One, it cannot take that long to keep making progress when we talk about women of color or when we talk about LGBTQ women. And number two, also recognizing what an incredible moment we are in, that we are now able to see the work of 100 years of women saying we deserve to be at the table, we deserve to have a voice and a vote.
Your comments made me think about a quote that one of the leaders of the women's suffrage movement said 100 years ago. This is from Alice Paul. She said, "It is incredible to me that any woman should consider the fight for full equality one. This is just the beginning." Those were certainly prophetic words. Desi, can you speak to your feelings about the 19th Amendment and what it both did and did not do when it comes to expanding voting rights?
I will be delighted to, and thank you again for having this, Kathleen, and having this discussion. Francine knows, and I've shared this, I'm not sure, with Amanda and others, but had the opportunity to do some retaping of a film that is going to be about the women's suffrage movement. And one of the things that I really need to point out is African-American women were in many ways excluded and not included in that movement. So to celebrate it, it has had mixed emotions for many of us because some of the women that were there, again, early on, that were paving the way, that was making a difference, that was leading the struggle, the Sojourner Truth and others, were not acknowledged in their rightful manner. You know, I think it was Francine that mentioned that the Frederick Douglass attendance at the first conference. Well, there was a lot of discussion and debate again about how quickly women should vote before African-American men. And so we have a lot of feelings about this. But the good news, now let me get to the good news. The good news is, again, that when we talk about 100 years of struggle, we realize that nothing happens in a moment's notice, that we stand on the shoulders of a lot of very courageous women who are willing to step out there and say, we too want a voice. And so that brings me to the point of mentioning actually BWAPA. And when I think about 100 years, we think that's such a long time. Well, Black Women Organized for Political Action is now celebrating 54 years. And that's what I think about that in retrospect to 100. I mean, that's almost half the time. And that we're the first organization of its kind to organize to really make sure that we got African-American women engaged in the political process. So when I see our lifetime member, Kamala Harris, and making her acceptance speech, it literally brought me to tears because it's, again, lots of struggles, 100 years of women of color, people of color, all women, and then 50-something years of African-American women really struggling to make sure that we were at the table. As Shirley Chisholm said many years ago, that if they won't invite us to the table, then we bring our own folding chairs. And so that's what we have felt like that we have been doing for a long time, is having to bring our own chairs. And so now to see us ascend to this level, to have an African-American woman being officially nominated to one of the highest offices in the land, is it's not only historic, but it's just such an exceptionally moving a piece for many of us who've been in the struggle a long time. So women's suffrage, I mean, it's absolutely critical that we continue to build on it. We're nowhere near where we want to be, but we're certainly moving in the direction that we want to go in.
You know, Desi, this is Francine again. Desi mentioned racism, of course, in the whole voting movement. And there were so many movements going,
yes,
kind of coming together into a perfect storm. There was racism, there was classism, there was,
right,
ageism, there was the whole temperance movement and the abolition movement all going on together. So this history is so rich, and there's so many different aspects to it. And since Desi, you gave a little commercial for BWAPA that it was celebrating 50 years. So I have to tell you that the League of Women Voters is celebrating 100 years. In fact, the League of Women Voters was formed 6 months prior to the passage of the 19th Amendment. So we've really been in there the whole time. And, you know, the other thing that people might not know is that there was a presidential candidate, a female presidential candidate, 150 years ago. Her name was Victoria Woodhull. She was born in Ohio. She was running from the Equal Rights Party, and this woman was so interesting. She was a spiritualist. She was also one of the first women stockbrokers on Wall Street, and she and her sister were among the first women newspaper publishers in the entire country. So, you know, women have been in there working really hard to get elected for a very, very long time.
And let me add, Francine, if I can. I'm sorry, Kathleen. I just want... Clearly, of course, I'm going to always support BWAPA, but I want to make it clear that we certainly recognize the League's work, have been engaged with them. As you know, we've partnered on so many programs. The NWPC, the National Women's Political Caucus, you know, remember that there's so many other political clubs that are doing great work for women and to encourage women, I mean, emerge and close the gap. And we're collaboration. We're not in competition. It's
absolutely
all about making sure that we continue to forge those partnerships as we move forward. But absolutely recognize the great work that many, many, many women organizations have been true to and have been thankful for many years.
And the League is very happy that WAPA is here working together with us, too.
So I'd like to shift the conversation just a bit and bring Ivy into the conversation. You know, from your perspective as a political scientist, I'm curious if what your thoughts are about the influence women voters have had on American politics, campaigns, and our elections.
Yes. So I think to add to what has already been said and what was just recently said, women have always been in the background trying to figure out how to first attain the franchise. And once that was attained, how to actually fully participate in it. Because let's be clear about the reality that while women were given the right to vote via the 19th Amendment in 1920, it's not the case that it was socially accepted for women to even be involved in politics. The reality is that, you know, social norms didn't necessarily allow for women to be a part of the process. Politics has always been considered a male domain. And so as such, women have always had to struggle and fight for the ability to be recognized and to also be elected. And so it's, we don't really, despite the ratification of the 19th Amendment, we don't really see women really exercise the franchise and begin to fully participate until the aftermath of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which, to add to what has already been said, really did give the franchise to all women, because now Black women and women of color were now also allowed to vote, because the 19th Amendment didn't, there were still obstacles that were placed for Black women and women of color and Indigenous women to be allowed to vote even after 1920. And so we really begin to see in the late 70s and the 80s and the 90s, where women start to take a more front seat when it comes to elections and campaigning and being political actors. And so it's really until the 1980s and the 90s where you begin to see that the political parties are starting to see that more and more women are starting to participate, and you start to see the development of the gender gap, where you start to see that women begin to deviate from the political opinions of their husbands and start to form their own political opinions and start to exercise the franchise in a way that is going to benefit their own worldview. And so with more women participating in electoral politics, now the political parties are now being tasked with having to bring into the platform issues that matter to women. So women really start to begin to influence the party platforms as well as their own candidacies in regards to the policy issues that they're willing to put on the forefront. Policy issues like healthcare, education, reproductive rights, economic rights, and even equality in terms of, if we're thinking about moving into the 21st century, pay equity. So women, until the later half of the 20th century, and now, of course, now in the early 21st century, we really begin to see women start to take their rightful seat with, of course, thinking about the official nominations of Senator Kamala Harris as the vice president nominee. You really see how women are now starting to play a larger role in American politics.
You know, Amanda, I have to ask you, given your role on Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign as its national political director, what are your thoughts about the role that gender played in that race and in politics in general for female candidates?
So, you know, it's interesting how much we've moved in the last 3.5 years. I have to say, when I look back to 2016 or 2015, really, when we were building a movement for the first female presidential candidate, there were a lot of folks, half the folks were saying, of course this is going to happen. And then half the folks were saying, is it really that big of a deal? And after Trump gets elected, what we heard on the campaign was, oh my God, I never imagined someone so qualified, someone who's done so much work, who was ready to step into that role, who was credible to be commander in chief, how that didn't work out. And that was a message to so many women across the board that what we heard last night, if you want it, you got to fight for it. And so from day one, you saw women marching in the streets. In 2018, you saw a record number of women running. I was a chair of Emerge and interim president of Emerge as well. And we saw women all across the board raising their hand and saying, I can run too. And not just women who have been in the political sphere, but women who were doctors, who were teachers, who were doing different kinds of things, saying, wait, I too can have a voice in my own government. That process that women went through to raise their hand and a step forward was not just in one city or one state, but it was a generational movement that happened. And then in 2018, to win in the ways that were record-breaking, to validate that you raised your hand and you won, really set the stage for a different kind of election this year, where it was an expectation that we would see women run for president, that we would see women on the ballot somewhere. And in fact, it became pretty hard for Biden to say he wasn't going to have a woman, because more than half the population that votes was saying, wait a second, where do I show up? And so I think we have really moved along quite well. I think the other piece that we're seeing change over the last 3.5 years is not just women getting to the table, but enough women getting to the table that the issues are a national discussion in a different kind of way than ever before. And I think that's the part that is even pushed forward even more. I mean, I remember being at the table on the Finance Committee during the Affordable Care Act, and we were having a debate as to whether maternity care should be a basic right. And the reason why that amendment passed in the Finance Committee is because there was actually women on the other side of the aisle. The idea that we had the vote, the Democratic vote, and a couple of women on the other side of the aisle is why that amendment was accepted in the middle of the night to make sure that maternity care was part of the basic rights of the Affordable Care Act. So it wasn't long ago that we had to make sure we had enough votes. And now we're getting to a point where not only do you have enough votes, but you now have state legislatures like in Nevada that are led by women, that are majority women. And I think that's the part that we are just on that tipping point, and what the world will look like, what the country will look like when we have the governing power, just like right now we have some winning power to get on the stage. And that's the exciting part of how I think about our future.
Ivy, you know, we are here 100 years after the 19th Amendment, yet there has been so much in the news lately about voter suppression and disenfranchisement. Does that surprise you?
It does not, unfortunately. I think it's indicative, once again, and something, an idea we need to always keep in mind is just how important the vote actually is. Because if it wasn't so important, it wouldn't be such a struggle to keep it as open and as free as it was once before 2010, when you started to see the rise of voter ID laws. And you also wouldn't need the 15th or the 19th Amendment or even the Voting Rights Act. So it's evident, right, that the vote in a Democratic, in a Republican democracy is extremely important. And unfortunately, we have seen the rise of voter ID laws, and then we're also even we're seeing the attack on the post office and mail-in voting, even though we are in the middle of a global pandemic, which I think does really speak to how important the franchise is, and also to how important women voters are. Because the other trend that we've seen, in addition to the trend of the gender gap that started to really become a thing in the 1980s, is that since about 2000, we've been seeing that there is a larger turnout on behalf of women than there is of men. Now, the percentages, the margin is still quite small. So it's usually about 48% men will show up to 51% of women, 52% of women that'll show up. So the margin is small, but it's still very much the case that more often than not, for midterm elections, for local elections, for general elections or presidential elections, which tend to garner the most attention, you see more women show up to the ballot and exercise the vote, which again, I think speaks to how important it is for women and how important it is in general.
We just have a minute or two before we wrap up, and I want to make sure I ask Desi this question before we finish. You have been doing the work for such a long time, and particularly that intersectional work, looking at how race and gender relate to political engagement. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to this moment in history and what your thoughts are about how far we've come and how far we still need to go?
When I think about that question, and of course, I've had to think about it a lot lately, as we all know, we're in this pandemic and doing a lot of reflection and course meetings and conversations, and having 78 years old, I'm very proud of that, we'll be 79 soon, having worked in the civil rights movement, having had the experience of been a part of SNCC and the experience of working with people like John Lewis and Stokely Carmichael, later Kwame Ture, and the women that were really engaged that often gets lost again in the conversation, because there were some strong, powerful African-American women and other women across the board that were engaged in the civil rights movement. That's really sort of led to my political activism to continue to make sure that, again, our voices are heard. And I believe it was Amanda that said earlier, one of the things that I'm getting the greatest joy out of now is watching, again, the younger women, younger people that are saying that we have got to engage and we've got to be a part of the process and we want to see changes in this country. So I am in many ways inspired and excited about the progress that I am seeing, that again, beginning to, again, bring all people together. I think we're finally, you know, people have been saying what I call giving voice to it, but not necessarily action, to their commitment, to their liberalism, to our progressivism, to our whatever it is we've been giving. But we are now seeing people coming together and saying, how do we really make this happen? How do we really make a change? So I'm excited about that. I think the sad part for me is, and what I reflect on again, though it has taken us this long, that again, many of us that were standing on the shoulders of people before us, but that have been out there for 50, 60, and 70 years fighting the good fight for social justice and equal quality for women and gender, for men, for race, to make sure that we were seeing real change. And so I want to just say that when I look at my grandchildren having to fight the same battle that I was fighting 60 years ago, it's a little painful. But the joy and the good news in that is that, like I said, I'm seeing a difference of people coming together in the collaborations, really making things happen. I think it's just so important, again, someone else said, that we encourage these young people to step up and step out and give them the support and the training and the guidance and the wisdom to be a part of, because if we have to start at the local levels, we have to be engaged in school boards and city councils and boards of supervisors, because policies are made there as well. And policy, good, strong policy that's going to impact systemic change in our society starts at all those levels. So I'm excited. I'm excited about the future. I see that we have made enormous progress, but certainly I recognize that we have a long way to go. I mentioned for many years, many people are now saying this, but for years we have been saying about the vote. African-American women have been the largest percentage of voters, and we voted the largest number, I should say, percentage-wise, than anybody in this country. And we have been doing that for a long time, and yet we're the least represented. So we've got to find balance. And as many of the women on this whole course call know, where we have served and worked and raised money and walked the precincts, we're still not represented at the numbers that we want to be represented across the board. So we've got a ways to go to make sure policy is that is important to all of us, because what's good for women is really good for the nation. And so we're going to be looking to continue to do that, and, of course, to make sure that we're supporting other women across the board to make those changes happen.
It has been an absolute joy to talk with you all today. Francine Farber, Amanda Renteria, Arvi Cargile, and Desi Woods-Jones, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you for having us. It's good to chat with you, ladies.
Thank you.